Morning, Mark Elliott, number 16845. Appearing today on behalf of the claimant, Ms. Karen April. She's the claimant below. I did not represent her below, but represented her on appeal. Since 1991, injured workers in the state of Colorado have been stuck with a unfair and restrictive definition of what constitutes permanent total disability, which we refer to people who practice in the area, PTD. There's a lot of acronyms in comp. Which basically under the statute, as it was changed and tightened by the legislature in 1991, says you can't be PTD unless you're unable to earn any wages in the same, which is the one that applies to our argument today, in the same employment, same or other employment. Now, we're not here today, I'm not here to challenge that restrictive definition. I'm always looking for a case where I could. I'm actually here today to say, based on the unique circumstances, the unique posture of this case, and more importantly, the respondent's stated defense to the claim below, we're here to ensure that the respondents, employers and insurance carriers, self-insured employers and insurance carriers, are stuck with that same restrictive definition. They can't have it both ways. They can't have the benefit of the standard and then not have it used against them in this unique, very unique circumstances. I've been practicing workers' comp for 25 years. I think Mr. Picardi's been for the same amount of time, and I've never seen a case like this. So anyway, respondents drop a bomb in opening statement. Again, I wasn't counsel then, but they said, we're going to defend this claim by establishing that Ms. April was not able to sustain employment for years before the work-related injury that she experienced in February of 2011. Ms. April had been a 15-year employee of King Soopers and had leaves of absences for issues. There's no dispute about that. The facts aren't in dispute about that. But what's also not in dispute is from November of 2010 until February of 2011, when this work-related injury to her back happens, she's working full-time. She's working for full wages. That's from November 10th to the injury in February of 2011. So those are the facts. She's working full-time for full wages, but the respondent's defense is she was not capable of sustaining employment when she was working full-time for full wages. That's where we're going to ask you to impose the same standard on respondents as is imposed on claimants trying to prove PTD. So Mr. Picardi said exactly what I said earlier. In his opening statement, the evidence will show that claimant was not capable of sustaining employment years before her injury. The ALJ in this case, in four different paragraphs, we'll talk about all four. In findings of fact, paragraph 22, and in conclusions of law, paragraphs 6 through 8, made findings that effectively, that found that she was unable to earn any wages before the work-related injury. And the key language in that respect is in paragraph 8. All three paragraphs, 6 through 8, support our argument, but the last sentence of paragraph 8 says it explicitly. Claimant failed to establish that the work-related injury was a substantial cause of her inability to earn wages since the totality of the evidence established that her multiple non-work-related conditions as they existed prior to the injury made claimant unable to earn any wages. That is the statutory standard. That's 840-201-16.5A. Unable to earn any wages. She uses the exact language from the statute. This is the record at page 841 of saying PTD. The judge makes it clear, and I think ICAO in affirming the judge below makes it clear that she never reaches the question of the contribution of the work-related injury independent of her findings and conclusions that the claimant was already unable to earn wages before the work-related injury. I think that's clear. ICAO says in affirming the judge at page 826, because of this, the ALJ concluded that the claimant failed to prove that the industrial injury was a substantial causative factor. So there's no finding or conclusion by the ALJ that's not predicated on her finding that she was already PTD or met the standard for PTD before she was ever injured at work.
Mr. Rowland, let me ask you though, the ALJ, I understand it's undisputed, she was working and was being paid, but there is findings and testimony that she wasn't really doing the job, that she really didn't have the capability before her work-related injury to do the job. What do we do with those facts?
But that's absolutely correct, Judge. There's findings about productivity, there's findings about efficiency, but those findings are not sufficient by themselves, and they certainly never were then applied by the judge to the standard for sheltered employment, which was created in the Jocelyn's case. So there's two steps. First, if you're not productive or fully efficient in your job, except for maybe the three judges here, then everybody could be determined to not to be engaged in sheltered employment at times when you're not being efficient or fully productive at work. That's not the standard. And that's not what Joslyn says. Joslyn's talking about sheltered employment is a case where a person starts the job completely as a volunteer, not being paid at all. Misses hours all the time, misses work all the time. There's no evidence of that in this April situation when she's back at work. In fact, there's evidence saying she wouldn't take a part-time job because she needed the money at a full-time job. So she was working full-time for full wages. So the inefficiencies or lack of productivity doesn't constitute meeting the definition of sheltered employment. The typical sheltered employment situations are somebody is given a position by a friend or a family member where they wouldn't be able to be engaged in sustainable or competitive employment without kind of a charitable or favorable, you know, a favor from this individual. So that's the situation. And the problem is those findings may have supported a conclusion, may have supported a finding or conclusion about sheltered employment, but that's not what the judge did. She doesn't even
mention. Isn't anybody talking about sheltered employment other than you? I don't recall. Maybe I'm wrong, but did the ALJ?
Never.
No.
Never.
And is counsel suggesting that?
It's discussed in the record in questioning of both the vocational experts.
But on appeal, that's really not an issue, then, whether or not it was sheltered employment.
Well, I think it is an issue because my argument is it's two steps, Judge Miller. First, if under the standard and under the McKinney case and under the Titan standard, if you're able to earn any wages, then you're not PTD. So in that regard, it doesn't have to be an issue. She was not unable to earn any wages, so you don't even have to reach the question. But the only exception to that for claimants is if you can still prove your PTD, even if you're earning some wages, part-time or whatever, if you prove that you're working in sheltered employment. So in the unique posture of this case, the respondents bore the burden of showing that since she was earning full wages and working full time, the respondents bore the burden of showing if they're still gonna try to show that she's PTD, they have to show that she was engaged in sheltered employment. And the evidence in the record on that is very clear. The only time it comes up, two questions to the VE, and in both situations, both VEs, the claimant's vocational expert, sorry about the acronym again, and the respondent's VE, both agreed, and that's clear in the record and stated in the briefs, they both agreed this was not sheltered employment. She was engaged in competitive employment, and beyond that, the employer agreed, and in fact, the employer said, on the day that she reported this injury, there's an exhibit in the evidence where the employer stated that that she was one step away from termination, one disciplinary action away from termination. So that, by definition, is not sheltered.
So it's your, well, let me ask this. If they had decided in November, when she came back and was so unproductive, that, look, we know she's worked here for a long time, but it's too bad, this is business, we're going to get rid of her right now, and then terminated her, then that would have been fine, there would be no issue. What's happened is here, they worked with her for a while, offered her other positions, tried to see if she could, if there was going to be an improvement, and in the meantime, she had this other accident. Just because, I mean, it seems to me it's what you're asking for is to encourage employers to terminate employees more quickly.
Well,
rather than to try to work with them and help them see if there's other positions they could find.
Well, I understand your position. I'm not an employment lawyer, but I've done some.
Neither am I.
I've done some in the past, and what I would say is, first, you know, of course, Colorado's an at-will employment state, but you can't violate the ADA. So
I understand.
There may have been ADA issues. If that were to happen, but that's not really the issue today. The bottom line is the employer didn't do any of those things you're talking about. The employer took back a longtime employee, had her continue working, had her continue to work full time for full wages, did take some alternate steps, and that's what we're talking about. So I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time.
Let me ask you a quick question, Mr.
Sure.
Elliott. The ALJ made some pretty specific findings. Of course, causation belongs to the ALJ. The ALJ found there's no direct causal relationship between the work injury and the PTD. And it also found the employer's witnesses to be credible and the claimant to not be credible. So what are we to do with those findings?
Well, again, as I stated before earlier in my argument, I think it's pretty clear in the briefs that the issue, it's very clear from those findings, paragraph 22 and 6 through 8 of her conclusions of law, that she's doing that with reference to her conclusion that she's not reaching the significant factor test under Siegfried without reference to her finding and conclusion, which is clearly wrong, that the claimant was already unable to earn any wages at the time, I mean, prior to the time of the work-related injury. That's the difference here. So I will reserve the remaining
okay.
time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. Steve Picardi, attorney registration number 21093, representing the self-insured employer King Soopers. Now, you heard the claimant's counsel state basically the entire crux of this case, which is the claimant contends that the administrative law judge never reaches the question of the effect of the industrial injury. And Judge Roman, you pointed it out specifically. The administrative law judge did reach that question more than three times in her order. She states that the claimant failed to prove that the industrial injury caused any residual impairment. And that's what this case is all about. This case is nothing more than a question of causation. Did the claimant present enough evidence to carry the claimant's burden of proving that the injury caused the inability to earn any wages? There's no question that the claimant had an injury. No question that when the claimant reached maximum medical improvement, she was unable to earn any wages. The question is, what happened in between that time period? And that is the causation question. And that is where the claimant failed to meet the burden of proving that it was the injury. Now, both judges asked about the findings of fact by the administrative law judge, and the judge goes into great depth as to what the claimant's condition was before the injury. The significance of that is the causation analysis. If you're going to find out whether the injury caused the inability to earn wages, one thing you have to determine is what is the claimant's condition immediately before the injury. And in this case, the administrative law judge spent 12 paragraphs, 12 out of 23 paragraphs of her order, detailing what the claimant's condition was prior to the injury. And she ultimately concludes that the industrial injury, she ultimately concludes in paragraph 12 that the medical records and the testimony of the witnesses established that claimant's physical condition after her return to work in November 2010 from her leave of absence for her knee infection, so for her non-industrial conditions, had deteriorated to the point that claimant no longer was capable of working for the employer without significant modification. The significance of that is that ALJ has stated that there has been this, in the 3-4 months before the injury, a significant decrease in the claimant's condition. And that establishes the condition just prior to the industrial injury. So now we know the claimant's condition prior to the injury. As of, actually, the judge even makes findings as to the very day of the injury, February 9, 2011, that the claimant still was complaining of that the claimant still was not being productive and was falling, I think it was 80% short of the productivity guidelines of that job. The judge doesn't reach that information, those findings, in order to show that the claimant was permanently totally disabled beforehand. The judge never finds that the claimant was permanently totally disabled beforehand. The claimant just interprets it that way in order to sidestep the causation issue. What the judge specifically finds is that the claimant was working, but she was to the point where her condition deteriorated and she couldn't work any position without some significant modification. That creates our baseline.
Can I just ask a question about something you just said a minute ago? When the court concluded that she was not capable of earning wages without significant modification, wasn't that a determination that she was permanently, totally disabled?
Absolutely not, because the standard is unable to earn any wages. In this case, the claimant was earning wages beforehand. Now, the claimant wants to point to the fact that in an opening argument, respondent's attorney, me, I dropped the bomb by saying that she was unable to earn wages for years before the injury. That was a gross over-exaggeration of what the facts present in order to draw attention to the fact that you have to look to the claimant's condition prior to the injury to determine whether the injury actually caused any residual disability. As a matter of fact, the administrative law judge, in her very opening of the case, when we were giving our prior to our opening statements, the judge asked, and on the record, page 401, what are the issues? And I respond, offsets and substantial causative factor, which really isn't an issue. And then the judge says, I guess the claimant's burden in a PT case to prove that the work injury was a substantial causative factor for the inability to earn wages. So the judge clearly was not determining that the claimant was permanently totally disabled beforehand. The judge was simply setting up a baseline. So now we have February 9, 2011, the claimant's condition, barely able to work and deteriorating, as the judge found in her order. Then we have an injury on February 9. Over the next 15 months, the claimant is out of work as a result of that injury. Then she reaches maximum medical improvement. The claimant's burden is to prove that the change in her condition, barely able to work before the injury, to unable to work after the injury, it's the claimant's burden to prove that that change was caused not by any other factor, but by the injury. And that's where the claimant failed. And you'll notice that not once did the claimant mention what the injury caused. What was the end result of this injury? There is no evidence, not in the claimant's brief, not in the arguments, no evidence as to what the claimant supposedly proved at hearing, as to what the injury caused. And if you look at it in that regard, the judge's order makes perfect sense. The first 12 paragraphs of the judge's order talk about the claimant's condition up to the date of the injury, to the point where she was barely able to work, unable to work in a position without substantial modification. Then the next 10 paragraphs of the judge's order talk about the evidence that the claimant presented in terms of whether there was any causation from this injury. Paragraph 13. Dr. Kistler documented the MRI showed nothing more than extensive degenerative changes, and that claimant's complaints appear to be much more about non-medical issues than medical issues. It's hard to see, in fact, what is the pain generator? And there have been many inconsistencies. Paragraph 15 through 17 of the findings of fact, the judge states, this is the evidence on what the restrictions are and what the claimant's functional capacities are. But then the judge specifically states that the witnesses, the doctor and the functional capacities evaluator, the occupational therapist who performed the functional capacities evaluator, failed to establish which restrictions were caused by the low back injury. Remember, she had all these other non-industrial conditions going on. So yes, she had restrictions. Yes, 15 months after the injury, she was unable to work. But it's still the claimant's burden to tie that injury into the inability to work. And the judge is saying, there's no evidence that the back injury did anything.
Mr. Picardi, is it your position that the ALJ effectively found that this was a charitable or a sheltered type of a situation based on the fact that she may have been barely working and her productivity may have been down, but she was working at some point prior?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The judge never even considered the issue of sheltered employment, because in order to get the sheltered employment, you first have to determine that the claimant has proven an inability to earn wages caused by the industrial injury. The judge never got there. The judge only looked at a pre-existing condition in order to have a baseline from to which we could compare her condition when she reached maximum medical improvement. So if you read the paragraph 8 of the, if I can go on to one last finding, paragraph 21, the claimant did not put forth full effort for her physicians in an attempt to increase her disability rating. These are findings of fact, which must be upheld if there's substantial evidence, and there was substantial evidence. So what the judge has just done is the judge just considered the evidence that the claimant put forth regarding the low back injury and discredited that evidence and found that there's no credible evidence that the claimant sustained an injury. And that is that the injury caused any residual impairment. And that is exactly what the judge states in her conclusions of law. If you, the claimant argued about the effect of paragraph 7 and 8. And actually, if you look at paragraphs 7 and 8 of the conclusions of law, you see that the judge did exactly what she's supposed to do. She considered, she did reach the question of the effect of the industrial injury, and she resolved that against the claimant. Paragraph 7, the weight of the credible and persuasive evidence does not support the claimant's contention that she is unable to earn a wage because of the low back injury she sustained. The low back injury has not been shown to be a significant causative factor in the claimant's disability. She clearly reached that question, and that was based upon the findings of fact 13 through 22. The next paragraph is the paragraph which the claimant interprets to state that the claimant was permanently totally disabled before the injury, and it actually doesn't say that at all. What it says is, the evidence established that the claimant was unable to perform her job duties before the February 9 work injury because of the array of medical problems she was experiencing. In other words, we're going back to that baseline. She couldn't perform all of her job duties, which is very clear from the evidence. The next sentence, claimant failed to establish that her work injury contributed substantially to her inability to earn wages, since the totality of the evidence established that her multiple non-work-related conditions, as they existed prior to February 9, 2011, and thereafter, made claimant unable to earn wages. So there were two options. I mean, we had the claimant's condition beforehand, barely able to earn wages, claimant's condition afterwards, unable to earn wages. Two options. Either one, all those non-industrial conditions ceased to deteriorate, and everything was caused by the industrial injury, that inability to earn wages 15 months later, or those conditions, those non-industrial conditions, continued to deteriorate and caused her inability to earn wages. And that was the claimant's burden, to prove that it was the first option and not the second. And in this case, the administrative law judge says, you didn't prove it was option one. You didn't prove it was the back injury. I think it was the non-industrial conditions which continued to deteriorate, because she specifically says it. The multiple non-work-related conditions as they existed prior to February 9, 2011, and thereafter, that made the claimant unable to earn wages.
But I want to go back to the a timeline for just a moment, and also, you said sheltered and charitable employment is not at issue here, but on the timeline, isn't a fact that she was considered to be at full-time work and wages prior to the workplace injury?
Yes. And that's my point. Sheltered employment never enters into this. She was a full-time employee. The claimant, the judge never found the claimant was permanently totally disabled beforehand. The judge found that she was working full-time, but that her condition was deteriorating to the point that she was really beginning to be unable to continue to work. Never said she was completely unable to, but her condition was deteriorating. The claimant wants you to presume that once there's an injury, all those non-industrial conditions then become stable, don't continue to deteriorate, and presume that now any change is caused by the industrial injury. But that's the crux of the argument. The whole point is it's the claimant's burden to prove it. And the claimant repeatedly said she never reaches the question of the effect of the industrial injury. And yet the ALJ specifically says in conclusion number 7, the evidence does not establish that the injury caused any problems. This is not an issue about finding her PTD before the injury. The judge applied the causation analysis, claimant didn't meet the burden, and therefore the findings must be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes and 58 seconds.
Excellent. All right.
Words matter. And the word sentence in that last sentence, paragraph 8, matters. And if you read 22 and 6 through 8 in context, there's no reasonable way to read those paragraphs except to conclude that the judge decided that the work-related injury was not a significant factor. She did say that, absolutely said it. But she said it with only with reference to the fact that she found and concluded that the claimant was already unable to earn any wages before the injury ever happened. So she doesn't assess the injury itself, and that's why we do have facts in our brief about restrictions from the work-related injury. There are restrictions. Their own doctor, respondent's own doctor, imposed restrictions, but we don't need to talk about those here, because the problem is the judge reached her findings and conclusions by saying she was already PTD at a time when she clearly wasn't PTD. She was earning full-time, she was working full-time and earning full wages. She can't be PT under Colorado law in that situation. And the judge said it in paragraph 8, since.
Mr. Wyatt, do you agree, though, that it's reasonable for the ALJ to compare the pre-injury condition to the post-injury condition in determining causation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what happened here is what we're saying is the judge reached her findings and conclusions with reference to her finding and conclusion that she was unable to earn any wages before the injury happened, so I don't have to figure out what happened with the injury. Those other findings don't apply to that. So it does matter. And to follow up on a question that Judge Miller asked, Mr. Picardi says, aren't you claiming that the judge effectively found that this was sheltered employment? And he dissuaded, he said, no, we're not claiming that. Well, three times in his brief, he says, that's what the judge effectively found. Page 33 of the answer brief, two times on the brief, he says, that's what the judge found. One time on page 36, he says the same thing. And on page 37 of the answer brief, he argues that it is at least a plausible inference from the record that the ALJ concluded that this was sheltered employment. The judge never talked about sheltered employment because they were, she was not thinking that she needed to address that issue, and she absolutely had to, because prior to the industrial injury, the claimant was working full time for full wages, could not be PTD, or could not be found to be incapable of earning any wages at that time, and the only exception in that situation, only exception, is finding sheltered employment. She never found sheltered employment.
Thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the court's docket for this morning. The court will stand in recess, and the bailiff shall so announce.